Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of Star Cells and God. This is the podcast where we explore the scientific case for the Christian faith. My name is Fuzz Rana. I am a biochemist, a Christian apologist, and I work for an organization called Reasons to Believe, which is the sponsor of this podcast. If you want to know more about Reasons to Believe, please go to our website, www.reasons.org. Or you can follow us on social media, RTB_official. And then last but not least, if you're watching this, please make sure that you go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe, and subscribe and set the reminder so that you get notified when the next episode of Star Cells and God is available. I'm joined in studio today by Dr. Hugh Ross, the founder and the president of Reasons to Believe, and an astronomer, astrophysicist. Welcome, Hugh.
Thank you.
You know, we are recording this podcast on a very special day, right?
What's the day, Fuzz?
It's May 4th. It's
May 4th? May the farce be with you.
Yeah, that's right.
Not force, farce.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's International Star Wars Day. So Hugh and I want to wish all of those people that are watching this.
But you know why I say farce? People watch those Star Wars movies and don't realize the humor that's in them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of embedded humor there. People are so fascinated with the, you know, kind of the theme and the battles going on. Watch for the humor.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. So you got Hugh's advice. But anyway, for those of you who are watching, those of you who are listening, we want to wish everybody a belated happy Star Wars Day. So may all of our listeners and viewers live long and prosper. So
there you go.
I just ignited an incendiary device in a room of gasoline. So anyway, enough foolishness. Hugh, why don't we go ahead and get started? You've got a great discovery that you want to share with us, so I'll let you kick it off. And then when you're done, I've got a couple of discoveries to share as well.
Well, the context is an article I wrote a few months ago. It's part of our Reasons.org blog series. Mine's called Today's New Reason to Believe. And I wrote about atmospheric physicists and climatologists have been using satellites to determine the loss of sea ice in the Arctic, mm-hmm. and how they were able to document that there's been really substantial loss of Arctic sea ice in the summertime, but not the wintertime. And basically what we were looking at was the geographical area that was covered by Arctic ice, and how for they kind of broke up the Arctic Ocean area into seven different geographical zones. And in only one of those zones has there not been a substantial loss of summer sea ice. But the good news was they weren't seeing any winter sea ice loss.
So the ice that melts then reforms in the winter months, is that what you're saying?
It does. And, you know, in my book, Weathering Climate Change, I made the point that when you look at the ice age cycle, global warming always brings on global cooling. Mm. And how we now understand why is that when the global mean temperature rises by a degree and a half or 2 degrees centigrade above where it is right now, it melts the polar ice cap. And that ice reflects sunlight with about 60% efficiency. But when it melts, the open Arctic liquid water reflects sunlight with only 6% efficiency. Which means that the Arctic Ocean, instead of reflecting away sunlight and sun heat, is absorbing it. And when it absorbs it, this makes for more water vapor above the Arctic Ocean, which causes more snow to fall on Siberia and Canada, and that brings on the next ice age. Mm-hmm. And the point I made in this article, this one here, what will happen if the Arctic sea ice loss continues, the article is posted on reasons.org, is that we really don't have to be so concerned about the loss of summer sea ice, because that water vapor will fall as rain on Siberian Canada, because with the midnight sun, it's going to be too warm for snow to fall in the summertime. So you're going to get rain. But if you lose the winter sea ice, you're now going to get snow mm-hmm. instead of rain. And that snow will accumulate. And the only reason we're not in an ice age now is that both Canada and Siberia are virtual deserts. They get less than 10 inches of precipitation per year. So yes, it snows in the wintertime in Canada, but not enough snow falls that it accumulates season after season. But if you were to say double the amount of snowfall, now it would begin to accumulate in a relatively short period of time. You've got hundreds, if not thousands, of feet thickness of ice all over Canada. And when you look at the last ice age, it penetrated all the way down here into Southern California. I mean, you look at Yosemite Valley. That was carved out by the retreat of thousands of feet of ice that was laid down during the last ice age. And, you know, San Diego, about a two-hour drive south of where we are, that port of San Diego was clogged with ice throughout half of the year. And it even went down to Mexico. Some Mexican ports would have been clogged with ice. So it's not just Canada. You know, a good third of the 48 states got covered with ice during the last ice age. So I think we should be motivated to stop this. And this is where this paper in Geophysical Research Letters is important. It got published a few weeks ago, Arctic Snow Depth, Ice Thickness, and Volume from two particular satellites that they were measuring. And this time what they were looking at is not what I discussed months ago, where we looked at the geographical coverage of the ice. They were measuring the ice thickness. So there's two satellites that are orbiting the Earth that are capable of measuring the thickness of the Arctic ice cap. And the two satellites are called ICE SAT-2 and then CryoSAT-2. So they've been orbiting for about the past 18 years. With two of the satellites up, they've gotten really good measurements since 2018. And this paper is basically publishing the results from 2018 to 2021, so it's a three-year period. And what they're documenting is that the thickness of the Arctic ice cap, 12% was lost in just 3 years. Mm-hmm. Now, the geographical coverage is the same, so it means that we're not getting an increase in snowfall in Siberia and Canada because we still have all that coverage. But it is saying it's getting thinner. And then when they go back to when they had the first of the satellites up, so they get an 18-year period, 33% of the ice has disappeared. It's the equivalent of 6,000 cubic miles of ice that is gone in the last 18 years. Bottom line, with the ice shrinking that rapidly, if this continues, it won't be long before the geographical coverage of the Arctic ice cap begins to shrink. And when that begins to shrink, you're going to have more water vapor in the wintertime over the Arctic, and that will cause more snow to fall on Siberia and Canada. And in terms of what we've seen in previous ice ages, what you see in previous ice ages is at the beginning of the coverage of Europe, Siberia, and Canada with thick ice, you begin to see it first in the accumulation of snow in northwestern Siberia, and followed up by the accumulation of snow in Labrador. And there are two papers published where they've been saying, we think we're beginning to see the accumulation of snow year to year in northwestern Siberia, basically that part adjacent to Finland. But we're not seeing it in Labrador. So the fact that we're not seeing it in Labrador yet means that we're not at imminent risk of the onset of the next ice age. But these satellite measurements are telling us, hey, we used to think it was only the summer ice pack that was being impacted. We now know that's not no longer true. The winter ice pack also is being impacted by the 1 degree increase, 1 degree centigrade increase in temperature since 1950. So the idea that we're getting an insignificant melting of winter sea ice, we now know that's no longer the case. A third of it is gone in just 18 years. So clearly, this is telling us we need to pay more attention to especially the warming of the planet in the winter months as opposed to the summer months. And so I'm hoping this will cause people to really look at what we've written in Weathering Climate Change and realize hey, if we're going to deal with this as quickly, this paper is basically telling us this global warming problem needs to be dealt with quickly. We can't wait another 36 years. Because if that happens, we're actually going to see significant shrinkage in the geographical coverage of the winter Arctic ice cap, which means we're going to beginning to see the onset of the next ice age. And really what I've been writing in Weathering Climate Change, if we're going to respond to this quickly, we have to give people an economic motivation, not an economic penalty. Economic penalties just cause people to dig their heels in and say, we're not going to do it, or we're going to wait. But if you give them an economic incentive, they'll do it tomorrow, or they'll do it in the next few months, which I think is the only way we're going to be able to preserve the Arctic ice cap. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying then is that as we experience global warming, what's going to follow global warming at a pretty close clip would be actually significant global cooling to a degree that it would usher in an ice age.
Yeah, and I wish I brought a visual with me, Fuzz, because if you actually look at the temperature records of the past 8 ice ages, what you see is a fairly rapid increase in global warming up to a peak, and then it suddenly drops down by about 8 degrees centigrade. This very rapid drop. And what would explain that rapid drop would be a huge increase in snowfall over Europe, Siberia, and Canada.
So, you know, with the global warming, the concern, of course, is rising sea levels and, you know, basically coastal areas being compromised. But that's going to be it'll still be horrifically destructive, but that's going to be then short-lived, where the sea levels will actually drop then.
Well, what we've seen happen in previous ice ages is that the sea level will rise by maybe 2-3, as much as 8 meters when you get to the maximum warming. And then when you get this ice age suddenly coming upon you, it drops by about 100 meters. Mm. And so the drop in sea level is going to be a far bigger concern than the rise. It's not going to rise a whole lot, although people tell you, hey, if it goes up 10 feet, that's
right.
Big.
Yeah.
I mean, there are many parts of the world where a 10-foot rise in sea level means you have to abandon the area. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Vancouver. A good chunk of Vancouver is below 2 feet above sea level. Right. So those areas are going to be flooded. And you go to Florida, a good chunk of Florida is less than 10 feet above sea level. So a 10-foot rise would be a big problem. But I'm arguing a far bigger problem would be a 390-foot drop in sea level, because that's how much the sea level dropped during the last ice age.
So because there are some people who I've heard argue, the climate change is real, but that what we really ought to be doing is trying to adapt to the climate change as opposed to try to stop it from happening. And whether that's good advice or not, it seems to me like the scenario you're painting is going to make that very difficult to do, because people are already trying to develop crops that would grow under higher temperature conditions, in differing, settings to make sure that we're able to supply the world with food. But what you're saying here is that those efforts may be for naught because of the fact that it's going to be such, climactic instability that any work.
Well, that's the problem. Once you get the global cooling beginning to kick in, and keep in mind the natural cycles are cooling the planet. They've been cooling the planet for the last several thousand years. It's human activity that's warming it. The natural cycles are cooling it. And so, once this snow begins to accumulate, we're going to see a fairly rapid drop. In fact, people have been speculating, hey, when the ice age begins to kick in, we need to up human activity to warm the planet in order to prevent all this. So if we can warm the planet enough, where instead of getting snow in the wintertime in Canada, you get rain, that would stop it. Mm-hmm. But you'd have to warm it by a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. I mean, Canada in the wintertime now is 60, 70 below. And so warming it enough where snow doesn't fall, you can work out the math.
Yeah.
That's simply not in the cards. There's no way we can warm the planet enough to stop the falling of snow. What we have to do is to stop the potential shrinkage of the Arctic winter ice cap. That's what needs to be done. And so I'm thinking maybe this paper is finally going to motivate people saying, hey, mitigation needs to be our strategy, not adaptation. Mm. And yeah, it's interesting you mentioned we can change crops. It is true. There are crops that will do well under warmer temperatures and crops that won't. And I wrote an article also on our reasons.org blog talking about C3 photosynthesis mm-hmm. and C4 photosynthesis, and how one has an optimal temperature of about 15 degrees centigrade. The other one goes up to about 23, 24. But the one that can tolerate the warmer temperatures is sugarcane and corn. A lot of calories, not much nutrients.
Yeah.
The crops that we're going to suffer with global warming are crops like wheat and rice and oats, millet. I mean, these are the healthier grains
right.
that are nutrient rich. And so moving to corn and sugarcane, I don't think is a good idea.
Yeah, well, and most likely what people are going to try to do is genetically engineer those more nutritious crops so that they are able to be productive at higher temperatures. Interesting. I think it might be surprising to people that human activity actually has delayed the onset of an ice age.
It has. We should be in an ice age already. And you made the comment too, Fuzz. Once we do begin to enter an ice age, you get extreme climate instability. So that's the real problem. Not only is it going to get colder and the sea levels are going to drop, you're going to have extremely unstable climate conditions. And we can see that in the human origins history.
Yeah.
Humans living during the last ice age had a problem developing and launching. I think they were just as capable as we are in mm-hmm. terms of launching civilization
I would agree
technology.
With that.
But they didn't have the climate stability to facilitate it. They couldn't grow the abundance of crops. When you've got a temperature that's, say, 8 degrees centigrade lower, the food you're going to get from the land is a whole lot less, which means a larger percentage of the population has to abandon science and engineering and focus on getting enough food to put on the table.
So what would this do to human populations to enter into an ice age?
Well, you couldn't sustain 8 billion people during an ice age. I mean, there's less land to live on, less land to grow crops on. But the real problem is you're going to have global extreme climate instability, which means you're not going to be able to count on the crops that you plant actually being able to produce. If you can't predict the climate, even month to month, then how can you count on having a good harvest?
Yeah.
And we see that in early humanity, is that yes, they were harvesting grains, they were grinding the grains and roasting them and making bakery products. They were doing that as early as at least 37,000 years ago, but it was all on a very small scale because of the climate instability. They couldn't scale it up.
Yeah. So what does this say to us about the design of the Earth, right? I mean, in terms of its habitability? Or does it say anything at all?
Well, it does, in the sense that if you want to have a global high-technology civilization with a large human population, you need to have an extended period of extreme climate stability. And again, I could cite another reasons.org article where we talk about how the last 9,000 years of human existence here on Earth, the global mean temperature has not varied by more than plus or minus 0.65 degrees. But a brand new study came out where they looked at the last 1,000 years, 0.06 degrees stability.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last 1,000 years, we've had what I would call a miraculous period of unprecedented extreme climate stability, and explains why the past 1,000 years have been a period of time of such rapid technological advance. I mean, you compare the last 1,000 years with the previous 50,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no comparison. We've gone from, having to get place to place by horse to where we're now able to send people to the moon.
Yeah. So anything else?
No, I'm excited about your discovery, Fuzz.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just to kind of segue into the discovery, yeah, I think we all recognize that life is full of twists and turns, right?
I know where you're going with this, but
you know, and these unexpected things that happen in our life can really derail our plans. And so, you know, we need to develop a mindset of how to respond to unexpected circumstances. And as kind of a way to be a little inspiring to our viewers, I've got a great quote from Condoleezza Rice, who, by the way, is one of my political heroes. There's very few people that fit that category. But
in politics, you mean.
Yeah. But Condoleezza Rice is indeed one of my heroes. And there's this great, great quote I found from her about the unexpected circumstances in life, you know, that life is full of surprises and serendipity. Being open to unexpected turns in the road is an important part of success. If you try to plan every step, you may miss those wonderful twists and turns. Just find your next adventure, do it well, enjoy it, and then think about what comes next.
I love the quote.
Yeah. But this idea of life being full of twists and turns begins at the point of our birth, you know, that actually the human birth canal is twisted. And so that during the birthing process, the neonate has to go through kind of an arduous reorientation through the birth canal.
And is this unique to human beings?
Yes, this is something that is indeed unique to human beings. And it has to do with essentially the design of the human birth canal. And here's a diagram I took from a journal article that I'm going to be talking about. And what you see is that in the opening of the birth canal, where the neonate enters, it's an oval shape, but it's oval transversely or from left to right. And so the head of the neonate has to align with the oval shape so that the largest diameter or the largest dimension of the neonate's head is aligning with the long axis of the oval. But then as soon as you get into the midplane of the birth canal, the orientation changes.
By 90 degrees.
Yeah, so instead of being oval transversely, it's now oval longitudinally. And so the neonate has to twist to adjust that. And then the outlet, of course, is also longitudinally oval as well. Now, as you were asking, this isn't seen in the great apes or in old world monkeys. They just have a longitudinally oval birth canal that doesn't twist. And that leads to a much easier birth. In humans, that could lead to an obstructed labor if the head becomes misaligned with the orientation of the birth canal. That can create problems in pregnancy, and of course that leads to the complaint that's pretty common among skeptics. You know, that the human birthing process really is poorly designed. It's an evolutionary outworking that is just a substandard,
and certainly
flawed
more
design.
Painful for the woman.
Yes. Well, not only painful, but also, you know, potentially dangerous as well. And so, you know, part of the argument would be, look, you're claiming that human beings are made in God's image. We're the crown of creation. Why on earth would an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good and loving God create human beings with such a difficult birthing process if we indeed have that special status within the creation, particularly when the birthing process in great apes and in old world monkeys appears to be not riddled with these kinds of risks, these kinds of dangers. There's another problem, too, that is called the obstetric dilemma. And I think most people are familiar with that. And that obstetric dilemma comes from the fact that we stand erect and we walk as in a bipedal movement. And that causes the pelvis to be more narrow than you would see, for example, in great apes or in old world monkeys, which are quadrupeds. They're knuckle-walking quadrupeds, moving around on four limbs, not walking erect. And that, of course, creates, again, a narrow birth canal. And of course, human beings are characterized by our very large heads, right? Some people have bigger heads than others, you know, but, you know, and that large head, of course, houses our large brain, which is very much part of our success as a species. We're, you know, we're unique and we're exceptional as human beings because of our advanced cognitive abilities.
So the neonatal's got an exceptionally large head.
Yes, that's right. And there's another aspect to that obstetric dilemma that a team from Japan focused on. So I'm going to be talking about two papers. And this is the broad shoulders that human beings have. So our large head, you know, allows us to have advanced cognitive abilities. Our broad shoulders actually help support our bipedal capabilities. It gives stability to our bipedalism, but it also allows for us to breathe better. And on top of that, allows us to have high-speed throwing motions, you know, which, you know, so being able to stand erect, having our hands free, having that kind of mobility of our shoulders is all part of that package that really contributes to our success as a species. But again, that, you know, the broad shoulders and the large head create problems during the birthing process. And so when you look at it as a package, you know, it really does look like, you know, what you're looking at, and at least on the surface, is the product of an evolutionary process where, you know, humans and the great apes and the old world monkeys all share an evolutionary ancestry. And the evolutionary process took this optimal design that we see in the great apes and the old world monkeys and kind of modified it as we developed bipedal capabilities, so that what we're looking at is a substandard evolutionary kludge job. That's the way, again, many people would view the human birthing process. And this is where the two papers I want to talk about come into play, because they paint a very different picture of human birthing. One of them is published in a journal called BMC Biology, and this is by a team from Austria that actually did a biomechanical analysis of the human birthing process. And what they discovered is what everybody, I think, felt to be true, which is a longitudinally oval birth canal that is, you know, continuously longitudinal from the inlet to the outlet is optimal. That's the optimal birth canal design. And indeed, you see that in old world monkeys and in great apes. But they argue that if humans had that same birth canal design, this would actually be catastrophic for the woman, because that design would create enormous amount of deformational stress on the muscles of the pelvic floor. Those muscles are doing a lot of work during pregnancy because they have to withstand the weight of the neonate as well as the fetus as well as the visceral organs. And then during the birthing process, those muscles are under even greater degree of intense stress because of, again, the birthing process. And so with a longitudinal opening into the birth canal, that would create, you know, so much stress that that it would be devastating for the woman. It would cause permanent damage to her muscles.
It would deform the muscles and the pelvic structure.
Yeah.
And then she'd have a hard time walking thereafter.
Right, right. As well as problems with incontinence, and the list goes on and on. So it's not a good thing. But by introducing a longitudinally transverse opening, you now actually relieve all kinds of stress on the pelvic the pelvic muscles. Now, you could actually get by with a longitudinally oval opening to the birth canal if you introduced tilt to the pelvis and additional curvature in the spine. The problem is that would create so much shear stress on the vertebral discs that it would, again, damage the woman's ability to walk after a pregnancy. And so what you're looking at really are trade-offs with regard to the twisted birth canal, that this is not that there's a rationale for this design. This isn't something that evolution just cobbled together and happened upon. There's a rationale for why it's this way. And it really is a trade-off between the birthing process and being able to stand erect. So that leads us to the next paper, which has to do with the shoulders, the developmental process of the shoulders. Now, when it comes to the obstetric dilemma, with regard to the head, most people are familiar with this. The way around that dilemma is that most of our brain growth and development happens after we're born. And so to accommodate that, the cranial vault doesn't become permanently ossified until much later in life,
right.
Much after birth.
And by ossified, you mean the bone forming.
Right. So yeah. There are these sutures. So they're the plates, but the plates are held together by these these.
Like with a newborn, it is really soft.
Yes. Yeah, a soft head. And that allows the head to be deformed as it goes through the birth canal, easing the birthing process. And then as the child grows older and the brain becomes larger, that allows for the skull, the cranial vault, to expand as the brain grows. Otherwise, if it was permanently ossified, that would restrict brain growth.
Right.
And then once the brain is finished growing, the skull completes the ossification process. But so that's well known. But what this team from Japan discovered is that during embryonic development, about 2 months or so before birth, the shoulders stop growing. They no longer grow. Now, this isn't true in great apes or in old world monkeys. The shoulders continue to grow all the way through the developmental process in the womb. And then they stop growing shortly after birth. In humans,
opposite.
And what happens is that the shoulder width is about the same dimension as the head. So you don't have larger shoulders, even though the head is more malleable and is restricted in size. But then as soon as the child is born, suddenly there's an acceleration of shoulder growth relative to other parts of the anatomy to make up for that. And so
I'm sure you've seen that, Fuzz. I mean, I was amazed at just how much the shoulders separate, even during the first few months.
Yeah, yeah.
So
And so, you know, what you're looking at here, again, is this really elegant compensatory mechanism to help offset, you know, the obstetric dilemma, which appears to be unique to humans. And so, you know, my point would be, far from being, you know, a flawed design, you know, or made up of a collection of flawed designs, the human birthing process really appears to be elegantly designed, where you have these very interesting and necessary trade-offs that, you know, offset, you know, what appear to be the flawed designs. And when you think about it, I mean, human beings represent as a biological system, a very complex system that is, in which the system is trying to essentially perform multiple objectives in the environment, right? I'm thinking about this in engineering terms now. And those types of systems where they're complex systems with multiple objectives made up of component parts have trade-offs. They necessarily face trade-offs, particularly when some of those objectives conflict with each other. And so what you're looking at here are necessary trade-offs where you have to intentionally sub-optimize aspects of the system to produce an overall optimal system. This is a very simple engineering principle that you actually see in play, you know, in the human birthing process, you know. And, you know, I've heard skeptics say, well, why wouldn't God just create human beings with a unique design to offset, you know, all of these problems? Well, you could create human beings very different than we are, but you would still be facing a different set of trade-offs. You're not going to get rid of trade-offs. You're just going to have different trade-offs, which, again, the skeptic would complain represents a flawed design. So point is, if we live in a world where there's fixed laws of physics, trade-offs are inevitable.
Yeah, it's like you're not going to be able to purchase a car that's got optimal fuel efficiency and optimal performance.
Yeah.
You got to kind of figure, okay, what do I value more? Or can I have a combination of the two? But you can't optimize both.
Yeah. Now, one other quick point, and this is a little bit more theological, and I think there's something here that I think you could play off of in an interesting way. You know, I interact with skeptics, as you do, quite a bit. And a lot of times when I bring up this idea of trade-offs, another rejoinder is, yeah, that's true, but maybe it was the evolutionary process that kind of evolved these trade-offs, because their argument is that, look, there's a shared biology between humans and great apes and old world monkeys. And so evolution just took this existing design and modified it to accommodate our bipedalism. And eventually evolution kind of created these trade-offs. This is just an evolutionary trade-off or evolutionary adaptations to accommodate or bipedalism.
So they'd be saying we got this twisted birth canal anatomy from the Neanderthals or a common ancestor
yes.
with the Neanderthals, that kind of thing?
Yeah, or even with the great apes or the old world monkeys if you keep going back.
Right.
And so they argue that, look, these shared features, you know, are the starting point. They reflect kind of the constraints of evolution. You know, evolution is just cobbling together this new design, working with what it has. And my response to that is that there's another way to think about this from a creation model that's far more, you know, that I think responds to that you know, rejoinder. And it's this, that, you know, prior to Darwin, people viewed biology in teleological terms. They saw design and purpose. Darwin stripped teleology out of biology. So its mechanism replaced the mind of a creator. But prior to Darwin, people talked about the designs in biology reflecting the work of a creator. And it's interesting because there was a debate raging among biologists whether it was function or whether it was form that was the organizing principle in biology, where people that would adopt the idea of function would think of biological systems kind of in engineering terms, whereas people that thought of form as being important saw it in like the way an architect would see it. But the point here is that form was considered to be a reflection of design just as function was. So along comes Sir Richard Owen, who thought to try to unify these two schools of thought with his vertebrate archetype, where he argued that the shared biological features that people argue is evidence for evolutionary ancestry, he argued prior to Darwin that this reflects an archetype that exists in the mind of a creator that then is expressed in the created order. And for Owen, he marveled that the vertebrate archetype is amazing because not only does it conform to this, not only is there a form that is conformed to, but that archetype is so versatile that it can be varied to create organisms with all kinds of different structural and functional features. And so in light of what we're talking about now, we could say, well, the birth canal that we see in primates, and in fact in mammals, at least in placental mammals, could be viewed as being an archetypical design that's so right. versatile that it can be varied in such a way to accommodate the birth of a wide range of creatures. And so it's amazing to think that this birth canal that we see in the primates other than humans could be that malleable, that adaptable, that you could produce, again, you know, a birthing process that would accommodate a bipedal primate with a narrowed pelvis. So, you know, that's a you know, another way to think about this. And to me, there's a reason why a creator would constrain himself in that way. Because if there wasn't these shared archetypes, whether we're talking at a genetic level, biochemical level, cellular level, anatomical level, physiological level, biology would be intractable. We would not really be able to have any kind of laws or rules of biology. There would be no science of biology. You know, we could study one organism, and what we learn from that organism would only apply to that organism. But because of these shared features across living systems, what we learn in one organism can be generalized to the totality of biology. And so now biology becomes discoverable. It's intelligible.
Because if you've got a creator God who wants us humans to develop relationships and use these animals, you would want them to have shared designs. So given that God wanted us to engage the nephesh animals, the soulish animals, use them for agriculture, use these animals for pets, use them to assist us in the various jobs you want to do, you would need to have shared designs.
Yeah. But what's interesting to me is that it suggests that biology is designed in such a way not only to produce, again, organisms, but is designed in a way that it can be discovered. And this is, you know, interesting to me because it's the theme that we see, that I've seen you write about in astronomy, right? That the Earth seems to also be designed in a way to discover the universe.
Right, right. Hey, I got a question about the Neanderthals, because, you know, my reading on it recently is that we humans have a bipedal capability that's way beyond what the Neanderthals are able to manifest. In terms of our ability to walk fast over long distances without consuming a lot of calories, there's a huge difference. And I'm wondering if that's reflected in the birth canal of the Neanderthal, the fact that they have a more barrel-shaped body. So what do we know about the birth canal of Neanderthals?
Yeah, I've done some reading over the years on that, and I see kind of conflicting perspectives on that. Some would say that the birthing process in Neanderthals was easier than in humans based on the pelvic shape.
Right.
And others say that it would be comparable, that they would have their own type of obstetric dilemma. So I really don't know the answer to that. I've seen both claims being made.
Yeah, where I was speculating, given that we have this much superior bipedal capability, that means that our skeletal structure will have to be different than it is from the Neanderthals. And we certainly see that, that their skeleton in terms of the pelvis, the backbone, it is different. And maybe that would be reflected in the birth canal. But I was just wondering if there was any...
Well, I mean, it could very well be. And again, I've seen some people make that claim, that the birthing process in Neanderthals was probably more comparable to what you would see in the great apes, you know, in the old world monkeys, than you would in modern humans. And that's an interesting, you know, perspective too, that the bipedalism was different. Years ago, I saw a paper that looked at bipedalism in the different hominins. And for the Australopithecines, they argued it was a facultative bipedalism where they not only could walk erect, but also retained the ability to knuckle walk as well as move through the trees. And in fact, the Australopithecines lived kind of in a mixture of a woodland open savanna environment, which that mixed mode of locomotion would have been advantageous. This paper then also argued that you saw an obligatory bipedalism in Homo erectus and Neanderthals,
right,
but they called that a type 1, whereas in modern humans they called it type 2, where they saw differences in the nature of the bipedalism. So I've seen that, but this was an article published 20-some years ago, and I just not have followed up on the
nature
of bipedalism.
There's actually some recently published articles making the point, the fact that we're tall and slim, and the way our skeleton is designed, and the way we actually have our intestinal tract design, allows us to traverse large distances at a fairly high velocity, 3-4 miles per hour, without using much energy, and actually make the claim this explains why we survived the two great cooling events of the last ice age, and the Neanderthals didn't. Mm. We're able to, you know, traverse these distances in our hunting practices with a whole lot more energy efficiency, and the reason is our anatomy is different, and the way our lungs and our heart are structured is different. But you know, when I read these two papers, Fuzz, it brought back memories to me of watching my wife give birth to our sons. Because the obstetrician looked at Kathy, looked at me, and said, "This is going to be an easy birth." And I kept telling him, "Look, I'm the shrimp in my family. I'm only 5'11", and I've got narrow shoulders. That's not the case with my male relatives. Some of them are 6'7½" and very broad-shouldered. And I said, you know, I think you need to be ready that this, because, you know, Kathy, as you know, is not a big woman. So I think you need to be ready. And he just kept, you know, and when our two sons were born, you know, Joel, our firstborn, 9 pounds, 2 ounces and skinny.
Yeah.
And I remember his head coming through the birth canal and his shoulders getting stuck.
Yeah.
And the doctor really had to work hard to get those shoulders out.
Yeah.
Very painful birth for Kathy. And so next time we had David, the obstetrician says, "Okay, I'm ready this time." And it was an easier birth.
Yeah.
And fortunately, David didn't have the broad shoulders of Joel. But it makes the point, hey, the human body is right at that limit.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of lot of wiggle room here.
Right.
Sorry to use that word. the whole point is God wanted us humans, as you say, to have, as we get to be adults, broad enough shoulders that we can have the the tool making capability, the throwing capability, and of course to have a big enough brain that we could engage in complex symbolism and language. And this requires that the birthing process indeed be difficult.
Well, you know, and scripture does make mention of that, right? You know,
it says, pain in childbirth.
Well, and increased pain. So, you know, that was that the difficulty in childbirth was not something that was introduced because of the curse, but really it was something that was part of the endemic design. But, you know, when you look at the birthing process, I think if you adopt a creation model perspective, there's a lot to marvel at. What you see by way of the design, that it's, you know, not a kludged system, but as you're pointing out, it's a system that's being that is optimal, that is accommodating the extreme of design limits.
Right, and I've actually used this kind of stuff, Fuzz, in dealing with astronomers who are speculating there might be intelligent life elsewhere in the universe with much bigger heads than we have. And it's like, hey, there are real limits imposed by the laws of physics. You're not going to get intelligent aliens with bigger heads relative to our body size than we have, because we are right at the limit of the laws of physics.
Well, that's all I have.
Okay, good.
So I think we'll go ahead and wrap up today's episode and just say thanks to everyone for watching. Please take a moment to share this podcast with other people. Tell them about it. Share it with them on social media or email them a link. And remember to follow us on social media, RTB_official. Please go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe, and subscribe. And then also set a reminder for this show. And until next time, remember, the more that we discover about science, the more we have reasons to believe. God bless you. See you next time.